Welcome to the Conservative Thought Hour, where America always comes first.
I'm proud to be an American.
Each week, we bring you captivating guests who will speak on many topics of national interest. We are not interested in telling you what to think or how to think. We have faith that you can do that for yourself. Our interest is to bring you information to help you form your own opinions. As always, the views expressed by our guests are their own and are not necessarily shared by the hosts or the station you are listening to. Get ready for enlightenment with the Conservative Thought Hour.
With all due respect, sir, I believe this is going to be our finest hour.
And now, here are your hosts, Carrie Black and Rick Stanner.
Hello and welcome to another hour of enlightenment. We are here with you on the Conservative Thought Hour. We do appreciate your time every week. It is Carrie Black along with Rick Stanner.
Carrie, how are you today?
I'm fabulous. We have another great hour. We say that every show, Rick, but we really mean it this time. We're very honored to have Paul Manafort. Paul, you might know his name. I'm pretty sure a lot of our listeners would. He's a political consultant and government affairs professional whose career spanning five decades has been devoted to furthering the interests of the United States on the world stage. As campaign chairman for Donald Trump's 2016 presidential campaign, Paul put into place the structure that delivered the nomination and eventually the general election for Donald J. Trump. Between 1975 and 1980, Paul worked on both the Ford and Reagan campaigns, playing a key role in the election of Ronald Reagan in 1980. In 81, Paul co-founded Black, Manafort & Stone, establishing the model used in government affairs and public affairs today. And Paul Manafort joins us. This hour, he is the author of his new book, Political Prisoner, Persecuted, Prosecuted, But Not Silenced. And we're so glad to have you on. Thanks for your time, Paul. Hi.
Hi. How are you both? Looking forward to talking to you today.
Good. Well, you came to the public's attention because of your trial and conviction, sadly. But your book shows that you have been a publicly spirited, family-oriented citizen for at least the last 40 years. Tell us how you got into public affairs. What was interesting about public affairs to you?
Sure. Well, I grew up in a household where public service was stressed, and my father was a three-time mayor of my city, and he was very public service oriented, and he instilled in me not only the values that I had growing up, but also the commitment to give back to the public for the blessings that my family had, and I grew up in a very blue collar working class family, and was very able to succeed because of the foundations that my parents put into me. And I lay all of it out, actually, nearly a chapter in the book, so that there's an orientation.
Yeah, and it is such a good read. I know, Rick, you were just enslaved by the book, so to speak. You wouldn't put it down, would you?
I wouldn't.
Yeah. I got a chance to read a little bit of it this weekend, too. And, Paul, I'm going to ask you, your efforts to help Donald Trump back in the 2016 election, that must have been, for lack of a better term, interesting. Mr. Trump, some say, is a man who sometimes seems to get in his own way. Did you ever talk to him about that, about toning down his aggressiveness or maybe the tweets and all that? Just curious.
Yeah, actually, in the book, I talk about some of the conversations we used to have, because Trump was a very unique candidate, is the right word, but of all the years in politics, I never had a candidate who possessed the range of skill sets that Trump did. And by that, what I mean is he was the candidate, but in his campaign, he was also the campaign manager, the pollster, the scheduler, the communications director. he had never been a candidate before. But prior to my involvement, I mean, the staff that was around him basically managed his schedule details. He was a one-man band and winning against a very experienced team of Republican opponents. But what he didn't understand, what happened, though, was the way a nomination is awarded to a candidate at the national convention is based on delegates as much as on primaries. And so he was winning the primaries. And then with his basically core staff, nothing else, he would go on to the next primary, leaving nothing behind. And the people he was beating were leaving structures behind. And they were actually electing delegates who were going to go into the convention, some of whom would have to vote for Trump on the first ballot, but only for him. They could support the Cruz rules or chairman of the convention or anything else. And on the second ballot, many of them were free to do whatever they wanted. And Trump all of a sudden started realizing that he was winning states and losing delegates. And he had a meeting with Reince Priebus, the chairman of the RNC, to complain. And Priebus said, look, Donald, you don't understand the rules. I mean, and then Priebus started to explain, you know, how the nomination is secured, at which point Trump turned to his staff and said, do you know these things? And they didn't. And at that point, Trump decided he needed to bring on somebody more experienced who actually had that skill set, which, frankly, I did. And we had mutual friends, and I sort of known Trump tangentially going back to the 80s, but we had some very good mutual friends who were recommending to him that he reach out to me. He did, and the rest is history.
Wow.
Well, you came in late, which means you came in what might be kind of an undermining position to the campaign manager, Corey Lewandowski. And that must have been difficult. Did he accept your presence?
No, he didn't, actually. I talk about that in the book. One of the big issues I had concern about was, you know, I've run campaigns before when people are brought in afterwards, and it's never a pleasant situation. Mm-hmm. And even when there's no basis for it, you know, raw feelings develop. And so I said to Trump when he wanted me to come on board that he needed to deal with his campaign staff, make sure they would accept me. And there's some humor to the story that I tell in the book. But in the end, he called me back, said it's all worked out. I showed up, and it wasn't all worked out. And I talk about in the book what that meant.
But you did the smart thing. You got his family involved. You brought them on your side, didn't you?
Well, you know, Trump, because he was running against the system, meant he was running against Republicans in Washington, governors, whatever.
Yep.
I mean, he was saying, I'm not one of them, I'm one of you, to the American people. And what that meant was he was the only one up there speaking on behalf of Trump of any, you know, who could test his who he was, the kind of person he was, et cetera. And when I got involved, I realized that Lewandowski wasn't using the family. And as I sat with the family for the first time, I realized this is a very special family. These they're not kids. They're young adults. But they were smart. They were attractive. Mm-hmm. They were totally connected to their father. They told an incredible story of their upbringing and the way he raised them that would resonate with the American people. And I decided that, consistent with Trump wanting to be against the system, I could have surrogates who could attest to Trump's personality in person, and not have to deal with political people out there on the hustings. And it worked famously. I mean, they were thrilled to be involved. They did a great job. And they ended up at the convention in a very historic and very unique way. I featured one of the children every night at the convention of the 4 days leading up to Ivanka and introducing her father to accept the nomination for president. It was a very moving week.
Phew, I bet it was. You know, Paul, you were talking a little earlier about older friends in the 80s, and can we go back even farther? You and Roger Stone were friends in the 1960s, if I'm correct, and you both found yourselves in very similar circumstances. What happened to him was horrible, starring in your own show, Pony Trials. Are you and Roger still friends today?
Yeah, we are. We actually did go back to college days. I was at Georgetown. He went to GW, and we got involved in college Republicans and young Republicans, and I was sort of the political leader. He wanted to be the candidate, so we elected Roger chairman of the Young Republicans, which was at that time was a powerful organization nationally within the Republican Party, and we put together groups of people who stayed with us our whole lives as part of our team in the campaigns we ran around the country.
Well, in reading your book, it becomes apparent that you are, I guess, from the conservative wing of the Republican Party. You said some really wonderful things about Barry Goldwater. And I'm just wondering, how did you fit into other parts of the Republican Party in doing your work that weren't necessarily the conservative wing?
Well, you know, but back when I was developing in my career, you could be of various political stripes, and that may be how you organize with inside the party. But when you're dealing outside of the party against the Democrats, you know, we were usually pretty united after the nomination battle was over. And frankly, even with Democrats, after an election was over, I found historically that we were able to, you know, continue to fight on issues, but be able to break bread, you know, when we weren't fighting on issues. So it was a much more collegial, less personal environment at that time. And when we took over the Young Republicans and elected Roger Chairman, that was, if you will, a conservative takeover. We were all young, young Republicans who saw in the future Ronald Reagan as our leader, and that drove our politics as we developed into the Reagan campaign in 1980, and then when Reagan was elected in 1980, Roger, Charlie Black, and myself created a firm, Black Manafort Stone, that started out as a political consulting firm, but quickly became, well, a government affairs firm specializing in international campaigns and international representations in Washington, and built our practice for 12 years in that firm.
Yeah, great. Well, Paul, we've got to take our first commercial break. Everyone, we'll be right back. This is Rick Stannard and Kerry Black on the Conservative Thought Hour with our guest this week, Paul Manafort. We'll be right back. Welcome back, everyone, to the Conservative Thought Hour with Kerry Black and Rick Stannard. And today we have Paul Manafort and his book, Political Prisoner. And I have to tell you, Paul, this book was not put downable. I literally read it from cover to cover in, well, it turned out to be about 8 hours. But it was just an amazing book. And I have to tell you, I've never been so disappointed in my own government as I was in reading this book. How about you?
Me too, going through that experience. Because I was going around the world trying to use American democracy and our judicial system as a model to help developing countries build replicas of us. You know, I'm sad to say that some of those developing countries are now more are closer to the ideal than our own country is today.
Yeah, you know, Paul, we were talking back in the day. You became acquainted with Dick Cheney back then as well when we were talking in the first segment. He's obviously not a Donald Trump fan at all. His daughter Liz just losing recently. Do you ever cross swords these days with Dick or his daughter Liz?
I haven't for a long time. Actually, I dealt with him in 2016 and persuaded him to endorse Donald Trump. He probably doesn't forgive me for that, but... But he was one of the people who did endorse Trump, in like April or May of 2016. And while he was never a avid supporter of Trump's, at least for a time, he was for him. And but I met Cheney when I worked at the Ford White House. He was the chief of staff at that time, and I go through in the book the unique environment I was in where. The people I worked with in that Ford White House campaign were people like Dick Cheney, George H.W. Bush, Jim Baker. I mean, these are the people that I was working day to day with on Ford's election campaign in 1976. And those relationships stayed with me for forever. Some are a bit attenuated now, but they were pretty personal. And at that time, we were all committed Reaganites and committed to Reagan's goals of cutting taxes, bringing down the Soviet Union, and building a strong government based on our Constitution and Bill of Rights.
Well, it's really striking to me how Reagan came in and did most of everything he wanted to do, and yet here we are today, back in the mire of big government and non-constitutional running of what our life is.
Well, in fact, we're dealing with one of the key topics of my or themes of my book is, since you've read it, Rick, is that we have got to deal with very actively involved now because we are fighting war against the woke socialist left, which is intent on destroying our Constitution and our way of government. And in the book, I go through those details. And I make the point, which is the key theme of my book, that, look, you don't just feel, you can look at my situation, you can feel sorry for my situation, but that's not what you need to be focusing on. Yeah, the danger isn't to me and isn't to Donald Trump only. It's to you, the American people, you, the MAGA world, you, the everyday ordinary Americans who look to your government to give you security and both economic and our borders, and you don't have that. And and I finished this book in, I think it was the end of last year, so I got the full year of the first full year of the Biden administration in my book, and I talked about the dangers that Biden was going to present to our constitutional rights because he's put together a government that is more radical than Obama, and and they are wholesale changes of the way we, of our country, and moving us from America first to one of a number of people in the global village that Davos talks about, and how the goal is not is to destroy our founding fathers and the principles of the Constitution they developed. And I predicted in my book that there was not going to be very long before Biden was coming after everyday Americans. And of course, now we've seen, since I finished the book, school board, parents going to school board meetings being called domestic terrorists, 87,000 IRS agents being hired to go after middle America, red America, like no doubt about that. And our constitutional rights and our ability to speak out, being abridged, and people who protested on January 6th, who if they did something illegal, should be punished. But many of the people languishing in prison right now, were there protesting the results of the election, which they have the right to do.
Right.
Yet they're without any ability to deal with a lawyer, with none of their habeas corpus rights. I mean, it's I can't believe they're still there over a year. From when it all happened, and this is what we can expect out of Biden, and he's doubling down. This Mar-a-Lago raid is just—it's totally consistent with the two-tier justice system, and the book really warns the American people that they have to take control of their future. They have to engage now, and they have to fight the fight to bring down this woke left before it's too late.
No, Paul, you are absolutely right. You mentioned MAGA world. Rick and I prefer to be called deplorables. I just want to get that out there, guys. it's just crazy.
You know, deserves to be called deplorables. She deserves to be called deplorables.
Yes. Amen.
I've got to tell you that the book opened up like peeling back layers of an onion, how our judicial system can work against us. And it is about as frightening a thing as I've ever read. Talk to us, if you would, about your travails with trying to set a proper bail.
Well, it was core to the narrative of what Weissman, who was the principal guy at Mueller's operation, what his whole strategy was. Because Weissman's reputation was to trample on constitutional rights when he's going after people for whatever reason. And I was warned early on by a friend of mine who was a lawyer in the representing Enron in the case against that Weissman brought against Enron. And he warned me that Weissman will he'll basically go overboard, violating the ethics of the law as well as the guidelines of the Department of Justice to go after people. And I needed to prepare myself. And he recommended that I read Sidney Powell's book, License to Lie, which laid out all of Weissman's horrible behaviors and tactics. And I read it and I understood it. And then I experienced it firsthand. I mean, what Weissman's key strategy, attacking isn't a strategy, is to destroy somebody in the court of public opinion first. So he destroys the reputation, so you can't get a fair trial. And that's what he did with me. I mean, when he first came on board, they started coming after me with all kind of anonymous government source leaks to reporters who, by the way, are the same reporters who are getting anonymous government source leaks today on the Mar-a-Lago. And started as a traitor, tied to the Kremlin, you know, a Russian spy. I mean, despite the fact that anybody had looked at all into my career, everything I'd done in life, bring down the Soviet Union and in Ukraine, was to bring Ukraine into the European Union, which Russia was 100% against. But that didn't, the truth was not a factor to Weissman. And so they did, and then he indicted me on a charge that if a Foreign Corrupt Practices Act charge of not filing a disclosure of representing a foreign interest that I had resolved already. I mean, when that was originally brought up by the Fair Unit outside, before the Special Counsel was even empowered and existed, the Department of Justice Fair Unit reached out to me because I was in the news, rumored to be representing foreign interests in Ukraine and not filing, and they wanted to know what the situation was. So my lawyer sat with them, and we worked out an understanding, and we reached an agreement where I did a limited filing because I didn't really think I needed to be filing at all, but I agreed to do a limited one to take it off the issue, off the table. No criminality, no civil penalties, no fines, nothing. Just I needed to file a document. Well, when I filed it, right after that, Weissman was appointed special counsel under Bob Mueller. And Weissman called that unit up, talked to the director, and said, what's the situation on FARA? She said, well, there is no situation. It's been resolved. And he said, no, it's not been resolved. I'm taking it over, and I'm throwing out your agreement with them. And then he brought criminal actions against me. The first time since the act was enacted in the late 1930s, to bring a criminal action. In the past, it always had been something that was negotiated out of civil, usually never any fines. But Weissman wasn't looking at justice. He was looking at creating a pressure on me to be squeezed to give him Donald Trump. So he indicted me on the charge that had already resolved. And then at my arraignment, they threw out a $10 million bond. John Gotti didn't have a $10 million bond. Drug cartel bosses didn't have $10 million bonds. And if that wasn't enough, the judge, who was an Obama appointee, Berman Jackson, threw a gag order on me so that I couldn't speak on anything during the whole course of my trial. Now, mind you, every day there was something being leaked out of the Department of Justice or the FBI about me and my exposure, like you see with Trump now. He's created, violated the Espionage Act. He's committed serious crimes. Lawyers won't go to him because he's such a bad guy. I mean, all these things are just the M.O., in the media to define you in the court of public opinion. They're doing it to Trump now. They did it to me during this time frame, during the special counsel's period. And so that by the time I came to trial, I was already guilty in everybody's minds. And the trial was simply, you know, the last piece of the part of the play. And it was never going to be able to have a fair trial in that environment. No. That's his MO. And in the book, I get into much more detail. I talk about the Russian collusion, the truth of what was going on, and what Weissman was trying to get me to say, what his strategy was, what his problems were in proving his strategy, and how, in the end, I totally destroyed his credibility on it, because by putting the facts on the record, I took away any possibility of there ever being any thought that Donald Trump committed Russian collusion.
Wow.
Well, did Weissman ever say to you, Paul, you're going to go home tonight and live a great life. All you have to do is give up Donald Trump.
No, he was a little more subtle than that. Not much more, but a little more subtle than that. Look, in his ideal world, I gave him Donald Trump, and then he threw me in jail anyhow. but in the end, all he could do was throw me in jail. I was not going to lie, and that's what it would have me to give him Donald Trump.
Wow. We're speaking with Paul Manafort. He's got a new book out and author. It's Political Prisoner, Persecuted, Prosecuted, But Not Silenced. And Everything you have been through, Paul, this corruption runs deep. You've probably found out who your real friends are through all of this. Were there any surprises for you there?
Oh, yeah. But you know what? I've moved on. I mean, yes, what got me through everything, especially solitary, was my family, my wife, who I dedicated the book to because she was my rock.
Yeah.
And my true friends who were there to make sure that my wife was comforted while I was stuck in solitary confinement and worried about me, you know, in ways that I could feel it. And there were people who should have been there for me, who I had done many things for, taking care of their kids, their families, who walked. But I don't dwell on that, honestly. I mean, I'm at peace with, you know, where I am today. I've moved away. I don't even think, other than writing the book and not doing the interviews on the book, that part of my life is over. It doesn't affect me anymore. And I'm taking responsibility for putting people in place to do the things that caused me to go to jail. But I know who I am. I know what I didn't do. And I don't feel like I need to go beyond that. So to those friends who were not really friends, they're not in my life anymore.
Yep.
And I have some people who weren't in my life before who are now, because without any basis for being there for me, they stepped up. And I'll never forget that.
Yeah. Well, Paul, we've got to take our second break. Everyone, this is Rick Stannard and Gary Black from the Conservative Thought Hour. And our guest today is Paul Manafort, author of the book Political Prisoner, a book you must read. We will be right back.
And we're back here just as we are every week for an hour of enlightenment with the Conservative Thought Hour. So thankful of your time. It's Carrie Black along with Rick Stannard. And our guest today is Paul Manafort. His new book is Political Prisoner, Persecuted, Prosecuted, But Not Silenced. Paul, really do appreciate your time today.
Oh, I appreciate the 4 minutes. Good to talk to your listeners.
Well, Paul, I have to give a shout out to your publisher of the book, which is Skyhorse Publishing. And the head of that company we've had on our show, Tony Lyons. Yeah. And he really puts out some fabulous books. And a shout out to Tony and his company for taking the chance again to do a conservative book.
Let me tell you, Rick, you don't know how true that is. I mean, there were a number of people out there who were trying to cancel me and trying to kill any book deal I could have. And Tony stepped up. He said, everybody deserves to have their story told. And he's committed to what I call freedom of the press, real freedom of the press, not the press and media that only prints when you agree with him. And Tony stuck his neck out, and I really appreciate it. Gave me a lot of guidance because, frankly, I'd never written a book before, and helped me frame the way I would think. And then when I wrote the book, they were just behind it 100% and have been still. I really appreciate it.
Yep, great group, and one of today's heroes, Tony Lyons. Listen, getting back to your bail, one of the things that surprised me was in putting up your properties to secure your bail, you got a communication from your bank that had a mortgage on one of your homes saying that your mortgage was in default. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, it's Weisman brought a number of bank fraud charges against me, which is basically he was saying that on some of the bank applications, I said things that weren't true, which frankly, the banks didn't think so. They actually filled out most of the stuff. I gave them the information. And in fact, all the loans were service loans that were in good condition. There were no defaults. And in fact, the banks were happy with me as a client. So, you know, but Weisman needed to create more pressure on me. So he created crimes that he said I committed. You know, as some of his evidence, without getting too arcane, I mean, you know, one of the properties that I had was a, originally the loan I had on it was for my daughter. It was her home. She was living in it. She moved overseas. And so she put the home up on an Airbnb without me knowing about it even while she was living in California. Weissman said that was a violation of the application where I said it was going to be for residential purposes, and that was a commercial purpose. And that was actually one of the components of his saying I committed bank fraud. And the fact that I didn't even know that she put it on Airbnb didn't matter. That was the game they were playing. And so when I was putting the bail package together, they knew I didn't have $10 million in assets, so I had to sort of cobble things together and ask some friends to help fill in the blanks. But one of my properties that I put up was a loan that was in good stead. It was paid up to date. Taxes were paid, or, you know, interest was paid. And I got it was rejected by Bourbon Jackson because Weissman said I was in default on the property, which I couldn't believe. And so I, you know, mind you, I'm, you know, in home confinement at this time. I'm not in solitary yet. So I called my lawyer up and I said, I'm not in default on this. And he said, well, call the bank and find out. So I called the bank and they said, no, you're not in default. They sent me my records. Everything was paid, the monthly statement. Everything was paid. Everything was current. And then one of them called me back from the bank, called me back and said, well, we have a note here that you're in default, but we don't see why you're in default. We don't know what you've done. And what I found out subsequently is that Weissman had called the general counsel of the bank. The bank was UBS, and he called the general counsel of the bank in Switzerland to find out about my loan. Oh. Yeah, all I had to do was look at my papers, and you saw my loan. And all of a sudden, that's when this mysterious default was declared. And I was told, when I finally confronted UBS, they couldn't deny that I was not in default. They said, well, it's a technical default. But if you can just get the special counsel to drop the charges against you, we can move it into a loan in good standing. And I said, oh, sure, I'll call Weissman and tell him to do that right now.
Yeah. Wow. There is no depth to which some worms will not crawl.
And believe me, he crawls. So.
Wow.
Well, Paul,
this must have been... Oh, go ahead, Carrie.
No, go for it, Rick.
No, I was just going to say this. How long from the moment Weissman determined he was going to go after you till you got free of this whole thing, how long was that period?
Well, the special counsel was appointed, I believe it was in May of 2017. And I was pardoned on December 23rd, 2020. So yeah, that was the time frame of the bulk of the race. And I go through all of the timelines, and I go through the trial. I go through the abuses in the trial. I go through how there was no way I could get a fair trial in D.C. and how the judge wouldn't let me move venue to a little further away. And so we detail all of that in the book. And I guess since you've read it, you know, it makes a pretty compelling case just factually when you follow the facts to see how abusive the system was and how weaponized the Department of Justice and the law and the FBI were. And of course, you've seen it again today. This archives battle, which has created an unprecedented raid at a president's home. Never in all the years of our country has something like that ever happened. And it's over a fight on documents that are in a secure place. And there's a process that's way less intrusive that can be followed to get the documents, if in fact they should be gotten. And when you think about it, the Democrats now, the same Democrats who tried two impeachments that failed and Russian collusion narrative that failed are now pushing this fake narrative because they're desperate to really remove Trump from the political world and at a minimum control the agenda going into the elections this November so that people aren't focusing on the disastrous Biden record but are focusing on whether Trump's going to jail, which, of course, he's never going to do.
Wow.
Well, I know I'm not going to ask you for the quantification, but I know this has cost you a ton of money. I mean, you talk about the time you cannot work. You talk about the destruction of your business and your reputation. Your lawyer fees had to be more than $10. Have you bothered to sit down and figure out what this whole mess has cost?
Well, it's still costing, and the answer is, cost me my financial security. I mean, it wiped me out. And I'm building my life back rather. But my wife said something to me as we were getting ready to, put in place. And the word was out that he was coming after me and he was coming after all my assets. And what I worried about was, you know, I had prepared things to take care of my family, particularly my wife and kids, you know, for life. For their lives. And that's what my life is all about, to take care of family and in some cases friends. And they had removed that. They were putting all that at risk. Mm-hmm. And so my core worry about my wife was now real. And she said to me, she said, look, we started our life together with nothing. Because both of us, I had nothing when I started, when I got out of law school. Maybe a couple hundred dollars. And I built my whole financial career. And she said, we started with nothing. We can finish with nothing. It does, as long as we have each other. Yeah. That's all that matters.
Lovely.
And last week, we celebrated our 44th wedding anniversary. And the point she made, it impacted me such that it gave me the strength to not worry about that part of the case. And while I never was happy to see my financial security destroyed, I realized that they weren't going to destroy what's important to me in my life, and that is my wife and my family.
Absolutely. Paul, can you share with our listeners the number one reason you wanted to write this book?
Well, there were two reasons. I mean, and they're connected. One was because I was under the gag order, I never could get my story out. So people think Paul Manafort is the guy who's defined in Wikipedia and in the headlines of 2017 and 18, and that those definitions, they're not even in the same world as me. They're just all, you know, Twitter trash, Democrat propaganda. It doesn't carry any of my values or what I've done with my life. And so I wanted to set the record straight as to who I am, what I've done around the world, because I'm very proud of my career, the countries I've helped become democratic, and the changes I've helped bring in a number of places in the world, including here in the United States. But I also wanted, and I talked about this in the first segment, I wanted to make sure the American people understood that while they can, you know, feel sorry for what I went through, they need to also be vigilant and fight back because they're in the crosshairs next. And it's about all of us, not just about me and about President Trump. And that was the overarching compelling reason to do this book. And that's why I took a year into the Biden administration to finish it, because I wanted to have the book be more about the future than just about the Russian narrative collusion.
Well, thank you for the book. It's absolutely terrific.
Yes.
Are you semi-retired now, or are you going to get back in the saddle? And if so, what's that saddle going to look like?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to be as active as I was. I mean, I'm 73 now. I mean, even if that hadn't happened, I probably wouldn't be as active as I was back then. But I am going to keep my hand in politics. I am going to keep my hand in some business things that are of interest to me, and to rebuild a little bit so that my wife can have some of the security that I'd wanted her to have, and you know, back 20 years ago.
Wow. Breathtaking that all that can disappear just because of some guy. Frustrating. I take it from your book that you're not, like us, a big fan of George Soros. is he actually a U.S. citizen?
Good question.
Who knows? And he doesn't believe in our Constitution, that's for sure.
Yep.
And he's committed to the downfall of our country as we know it. And I find him to be a very bad person.
Yeah, for sure. If the Republican Party wins, Paul, in the House in November, do you think there will be any payback, so to speak, for all the wrongs that he's been involved in?
Well, I don't know that there should be payback, but I think that, in other words, I think it's incumbent on the new Republican majority and expected upon of them to expose into light the corruption that has happened in the Obama and Biden governments and where there is corruption that involves people outside of the government, like Soros. That needs to be exposed too. If we don't do that, then we will not be fulfilling part of our mandate. Now, I don't think it should be mean and vicious. I think shedding light on the corruption is enough so that then a government can get elected in 24 that can get set things straight. And so it's important that Republicans don't look like it's a retaliatory thing, but in fact looks like it's, you know, protecting our Constitution to expose the corruption.
Well, I agree with you in part, but, you know, when somebody commits murder, somebody shoots somebody, we take their tool away from them. We take their gun away from them.
Right.
Why don't George Soros's tool is his money?
Yeah.
We need to take his money away from him.
Well, we certainly need to show where he is misspending, abusing it. I mean, you're right. That's what I mean about shining the light on it. And then you let chips fall where they may. And that's where the justice system needs to be one-tiered. It's got to be just, you know, equal justice under law for all. And that exposure, I think, will do that.
Well, we've got about 5 minutes left, and we've got an important election coming up this November. What are your thoughts on the midterms?
Yeah, well, it's interesting to note that the media is desperately trying right now to revive the Democrats' prospects in November. And let me tell you, they're barely... To claim that the elections always have a natural close, so they're never as wide at the end as they are at different points during the lead-up. But the reality is this Democratic majority is going to be gone in November. Republicans are going to win. They're going to win. The key is we got to spend the campaign focusing on the failures of the Biden administration, the disasters of the Pelosi-Schumer Congress, and make the case. Now, the good news is the case is already made every morning at the tables of American people when they have to think about getting in their car, get gas, and go to the grocery store to buy groceries. You know, Biden can say all he wants, zero inflation in July. But to the American people at the dinner tables and the breakfast tables, they know it's a lie. And so the more Biden says that, the more they distrust him and believe him to be the liar that he is. And so as long as we keep our focus on that record, we're going to win big. And contrary to, you know, what Mitch McConnell and some of the other Republicans are saying, I think we can win both houses of the Senate, of the Congress. And I think we're going to make great gains in the state legislative races, some school board races. I mean, Florida is focusing now under Governor DeSantis. They're focusing on school board races. They've just knocked out a bunch of people, from the primaries last week in Florida, yep, who were allowing critical race theory to be part of agendas in grammar schools. And so I think it's going to be a very earth-shattering election. And the more you read the Democrats saying it's closing, the Washington Post saying it's now a chance that Pelosi is going to keep her speakership, that's how desperate they are. And just like Biden can say zero inflation and fool nobody, the Washington Post and Democrats can say close election, they're not fooling anybody either.
Well, it's the same music they tried to sing in 2016, that there was no prayer of a guy named Donald J. Trump winning the election. Well, they can sing all they want. The proof happens at the election. That's the only poll that counts.
Yep. Yep.
Paul, where can our listeners get your book, Paul?
The book is actually in the public arena now. You can get it on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or Simon & Schuster or bookstores. Most bookstores should have it now. You can order it online and have it within 24 hours, I'm told, from Amazon. So it's people are hearing some of these interviews and ordering it when I finish, and they're getting the book the next day.
Fabulous. And I highly recommend it. I couldn't put it down even when I was trying to go to bed at night.
But I'm glad you couldn't put it down.
Thank you so very much for your time today, Paul. And good luck in the future.
Thank you, Rick, and thank you, Carrie. Talk to you soon again.
You've been listening to another hour of the Conservative Thought Hour. American Endeavor is the parent company of the Conservative Thought Hour. We believe in the freedoms guaranteed by our Constitution. We understand that our constitutional rights are not given to us by any government, so they cannot be taken away from us by any government. They are natural rights that belong to all Americans. We believe that government is not the solution to our problems. It is the cause of our problems. And so we know that the best government for us is the smallest government possible. These two beliefs are the core of conservatism and American Endeavor. You can find out more about American Endeavor and our efforts to sustain conservatism by going to our website at www.AmericanEndeavorInc.com. That's AmericanEndeavorInc.com. There you can subscribe to and read all back issues of our free newsletter, The American. You can watch our video series, Reliving Our Past, a series of short 60-second videos about the people and events that have shaped America. And you can join us in our efforts to reclaim our country from those who want to destroy it. Once again, our website is www.AmericanEndeavorInc.com. And please like our Facebook page at www.facebook.com/AMENDINC. Come visit us, learn about our efforts to promote conservatism, and find out how you can join us.
Thank you for listening to the Conservative Thought Hour. Remember what Albert Einstein said: the world is a very dangerous place, not because of the evil men in it, but because of the good men who do nothing.